We ended last time I was with you in Revelation chapter number 2, considering the first letter to the seven churches, which was to Ephesus. And we covered a lot of ground, and there were a lot of things I wanted to say that I was not able to say, and I'm not going to take the time to do it today. But if you'll remember, what we ended on was this, is Jesus in these letters, at least in some of them, he rebukes congregations. He also gives words of encouragement. He gives commendations to all of us, all of them. But of the seven, some of them he does not rebuke for anything. Others he does. He did rebuke the Ephesians. And the reason for that rebuke was this, was they had forgotten their first love. And this is where we ended. And our challenge was this, was maybe to come up with some idea of what we believe to be the first love of Springs Presbyterian Church. And ask the questions of ourselves, are we still being faithful to that particular first love? And we decided probably what it was this, was just a great belief in an almighty and powerful God who is able to accomplish all kinds of things, anything he determines to accomplish in spite of people. He's not dependent upon us at all to accomplish anything. He uses us to accomplish things all the time. But he's able to do the impossible, and he does it over and over and over again. Now, let me just maybe conclude with this idea, and that is we should all be able to look at ourselves and see ourselves as the greatest miracle of God, because we know ourselves probably better than anyone else does. And so we should be able to look at ourselves and say, look what God did. God saved even me. Okay, well, we're going to be picking up this morning with verses 8 through 11. So read with me if you would. And the angel of the church in Smyrna arise, the first and the last who was dead and who has come to life, says this, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. Remember, these churches are clustered, kind of within 100 miles of one another in the western south of Asia Minor, what we would call Turkey today. What you're going to find is this, is the vast majority of them, if not all of them, had Greek roots. They actually at one time had been colonies that that came by the hands of people who were leaving Greece for one reason or another. So there's a lot of Greekness that you're going to find in all of these different cities. Smyrna was named after myrrh. Now, myrrh's not a place. But we know something of myrrh. Myrrh was an aromatic resin that was very expensive, that just had a sweet smell to it. Just think about it, maybe is what people would use as air freshener today in their home to make it smell really good. It was expensive. We know it was one of those gifts that the three wise men brought to Jesus. But Smyrna, the name Smyrna, is derived from the fact they were a producer of myrrh. It was a very commercialized city. There was a significant Jewish population. There was a synagogue in Smyrna. There is belief that Smyrna was actually the hometown of Homer. Remember Homer? The Iliad and the Odyssey? The Greek poet? As we said in this letter, as with all the other letters, that what follows is the salutation to the particular city and the church there. And in particular here, remember this, that he's writing these letters to the messengers, the angels or possibly pastors of these seven churches. But that these letters obviously are to be shared amongst the churches and with all the people. And with you and I today. He describes himself, Jesus, remember, as the author of these letters. And he describes himself as the first and the last who was dead and who has come to life, says this. Can anyone read that and not doubt that Jesus is describing himself? Actually, he's describing two primary characteristics of who he is. The first and the last is a common phrase that you find in the Old Testament. And guess who it's always applied to? To God. He is the first. He is the last. It's very easy to see, understand in this last part of the description that Jesus is the one who was dead and that he was come to life once again, right? The point I'm trying to make is this. Is we find in that little description that Jesus gives of himself a description of his personhood, who he is, that he is both God and he is also man, the God-man. And we've talked a lot about this in the past, and you know, when we think about all that Jesus did and who Jesus is, you know, he's eternal God. He's always been. There was never a time that the Father was that he was not. He's always been. And he is and he always will be God. With all the power and the authority and everything that goes along with that. He's God in every sense that God the Father is God. But at the same time, he is man. And he's man in the same sense that you and I are, except for one thing, and that is he was without sin. But other than that, Jesus is just as we are. And he continues to be human in the heavenly throne room of God, as we're speaking right now, that he is there present in his physical human sense or nature. Have you ever wondered about the gospel? Why come up with something like this? Where the Father would have to send his only begotten Son that he's known forever, who is loved with a love that is beyond our comprehension, a million times beyond our comprehension. Why in the world the Father would send the Son into the world to live and die for people like us? I really believe this, that there was no alternative, that if God in fact was going to save Scott Kemper or Robert Helveston or Julie Mock, there was only one way possible for that to happen, and that is for things to play out exactly the way they did. There's no other reason I can conceive of that God would put Jesus through everything that he did. All the hurt, the harm, the humiliation, the torture, the horrible death, etc., etc., etc. I cannot believe that God the Father would have put his Son through those things if they were not absolutely essential to save us. Certainly, if there were an alternative pathway, he would have taken it. So here we have Jesus, the God-man. And he says to the church, I know your tribulation. He knows everything. He sees everything. He hears everything. He knows every thought that goes through the mind of every person that has ever breathed air. And he knows all that stuff at the same time. It's not that he's listening to Grady for a few minutes and then he turns his attention to Charlie. He knows what Grady's thinking and Charlie's thinking all at the same time, and that includes every person in the whole world. He's an amazing being in a great sense beyond our comprehension. He knows. He sees. When his children are being treated wrongly and harshly by other people, nothing passes by him. He sees every trial. He sees every tribulation that every believer has ever gone through. He sees your trials. He sees your tribulations. He knows where you are. He knows exactly what you're going through right now. Just like Ephesus, Smyrna was not a place that was conducive to Christian life. As a matter of fact, the general atmosphere, environment in Smyrna was hostile toward Christians, hostile toward Christianity. We understand that this was a first-generation church, or maybe getting into the second generation at this point, but a relatively young church. And we know that it was an environment that was hostile toward, and we'll get to something later on that really shows us just how hostile it was. In other words, it was a place where it was not easy to be a Christian. It was not easy to profess faith in Jesus Christ. Very often when you did that, and we need to understand a lot of these people in this church probably were Jewish converts. And when they converted to Christianity, they very often were ostracized by family. They were kicked out of their families. Their families would have nothing to do with them. They all had lifelong friends. And some of those friends at least would cut them off completely. One of the things that's pretty clear here is this, is many of the people in Smyrna lived in abject poverty. As we said before, Smyrna was a city of great commerce. It was a city of great prosperity. So they lived in this place where people were prospering upside down and backwards, everybody very often, but them. They lived very often in abject poverty. Because people would break off all connection with them. In other words, there were many people there, if they found out you were a Christian, they wouldn't hire you. They wouldn't pay you to do a job. There were a lot of other people there that if you had some kind of a business, and let's say you sold something, and they found out you were a Christian, they would not no longer be a patron of yours. This is the life that they lived, guys. It was not an easy life. It was a hard life. It was a life that could be characterized in a lot of ways, but one of those is it was a life of real tribulation. That they suffered daily for one reason, and that reason was their association with Jesus Christ. And Jesus knew it. And Jesus saw it. But you are rich. In other words, what these people were doing was this, is they weren't not building their treasures up on earth. They were building their treasures in heaven, which is ultimately what matters. Now, Jesus describes the treasure of this world as, you know, those things that rust away, the moths eat. But heavenly treasures are those things that are eternal. They are the ones that have real value. They are worth living a life of abject poverty for. So one of the questions that we should be looking at this morning is this: is where are our treasures really? Honestly, where really are our treasures? What are those things that we consider to be the most important things in life? Is God really the focus of everything? Well, a good way to have an idea about this is to do things like look at your checkbook. See where you spend your money. I mean, basically, do you look at your checkbook as just a means of getting all of those worldly treasures that you've wanted and, you know, this, that, and the other? Or when you look at your checkbook, do you see evidence there that you have a heart of mercy, that you have a heart of giving, not just to God, but to people around you? There's a wealth to be sought after, but it's not worldly wealth. It's heavenly wealth. Eternal wealth. Kingdom wealth. But the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Just remember this, that like we said before, there's a good chance at least some of these were Jewish converts. And we know this. We know the Jewish people believed that they had all the answers and that they had God's favor and all that, that they remain the chosen people of God, etc., etc. But at the same time, we understand this, that very often persecution of the church early on, it began with the Jews, and it continued with the Jews. And in the midst of that persecution, very often the persecutors became believers themselves. He describes them as synagogues of Satan. Now, I want to be real clear here, guys. I am not anti-Semitic. The Bible is not anti-Semitic. You need to understand that. But the important thing is this, is we need to understand something. Is that Jesus is the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father but through him. And that means no one, no Jew or no Gentile, no one. That Jesus is the path of salvation, not only for Gentiles, but it's also the path of salvation, the only path of salvation for Jewish people too. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Are you afraid of suffering? You know, I would imagine that most people that relish the idea of suffering, there's something kind of messed up in their head a little bit. Most of us don't go out looking to suffer. You know, we don't wake up in the morning and say, you know, what great way can I figure out to suffer today? Because I just love to suffer. But I just want to remind us this morning that suffering is part of being a Christian. Jesus says this: if the world hated me, it's going to hate you. And because that's true, there is a sense in which every believer, not just some, not special, not particular ones, But every believer will suffer in their life for one reason. And the reason is because of their faith in Jesus Christ. Without exception. Suffering is part of the picture. Well, how would you react if you got the news from God today that you were going to be thrown in prison for 10 days and that your life might be threatened? I can't say this any clearer than this. And that is, there's a sense in which no one will enter the kingdom of heaven that does not suffer, at least to some degree, for being a Christian. That's how important this is. Now, some of you know what I'm talking about. Some of you suffer. Some of you have been ostracized by family because you converted to Christianity. You became one of those church people, these fanatical church people. The suffering is part of it, and I do believe this, and we talked about this quite a bit in the past, and that is, you know, for some reason in our culture today, we've got it in our head, if we ever suffer for anything, for any reason, what we need to do is whatever we have to completely alleviate that suffering as quickly as possible. It's like we've developed in our mind that we're not supposed to ever suffer. Physically, emotionally, or any other way. But guys, that's contrary to our culture. We are called to suffer. It's part of the picture. And it's a good thing that it is. Suffering is not always a bad thing. Sometimes by suffering, you and I learn hard lessons that we would not learn otherwise. Like our utter and absolute dependence upon God. It's like raising children. Those of you who have adult children, you know, you've given them advice and counsel all those years you were raising them, and now they're out as young adults, and you're still trying to give them advice and counsel, and sometimes it doesn't seem like they ever listen to anything you tell them, and then they suffer as a consequence. But we just need to remember this, that suffering plays a key role in our maturing as a Christian. Without it, we won't grow. And we should never be satisfied where we're at. We should always be desiring to grow deeper in our faith and our relationship with Jesus. Some of you probably heard of a guy named Polycarp. You ever hear of Polycarp? Funny, kind of a funny name, right? Always wants me to think about Polly want a cracker or something. Polycarp. He was actually a disciple of the Apostle John, the one who's writing this letter. He's also one of the earliest martyrs of the church. He was the bishop of the church in Smyrna. Right about the time that this letter was being written, or shortly after, maybe a few decades afterward. He gave his life because he refused to acknowledge Caesar as Lord. The soldiers came to arrest him, and they say that what Polycarp did was he ordered his housekeepers to prepare a meal for them, and they sat down, and he asked them to give him an hour so he could pray. And so he took that hour, and he prayed, and they ate a meal that he had prepared for those people. And they took him, and when they took him into the stadium where everyone was gathered. And there was a voice that spoke out of heaven, "Play the man Polycarp." Now, exactly what that means, I can't tell you. But a lot of people heard it, this voice out of nowhere. He was encouraged to recognize Caesar as his Lord. And he basically says, how can I do that when the real Lord, my Lord, has been faithful to me all of these 86 years of my life? He was 86 years old when he died. They tied him to the stake. They lit the fire. And evidently the fire would not approach him. He was in there in the midst of the fire, not being burned. They took a sword and thrust him through. And this is kind of gory, but they say that so much blood came out that it put the fire out. Polycarp, the bishop of Smyrna, a martyr for the faith. He paid the ultimate price. You know, we're talking about Memorial Day tomorrow, which is important to us, and we need to remember all of those who have fallen on the battlefield for our betterment, you know, protecting the freedoms of speech and the freedom of religion that you and I have here today. But I'm not so sure that we shouldn't have a Memorial Day for the martyrs. A day when we think about all of the people in past ages that have given their lives for the cross of Christ, for the propagation of the church, so that things like you and I being able to sit here in Springs Presbyterian Church in this building on Sunday morning with all freedom to do that have made those things possible. We live really in a culture where we've been very much protected from things for a very long time, to the point now that is typically is the case that people begin to take things for granted. In other words, it's very easy for us to take for granted the freedom of religion, our freedom to be able to do what we're doing here this morning, without really giving much consideration that there's a large percentage of people in the world who cannot do that because they live in places where it's illegal for you to, under the threat possibly of imprisonment or your death. In other words, the environment that we found in Smyrna, as far as the church goes, is not non-existent in the world today, that there are places in the world where it's thriving and growing and doing very well. We're seeing today the beginnings of us losing our freedom of speech. And let me tell you, Christians will very often say things in this culture today that are politically incorrect. And we have to be politically incorrect if we want to speak forth God's truth. It has to be. But we're seeing it. You agree with me that we're seeing to some degree this curtailment of our freedom of speech. We can't even voice our opinion anymore without being attacked because of it, threatened because of it. But our freedom of speech will be the first to go. You know what will be number two? Freedom of religion. We've lost a lot of ground in our land. 1955, 71% of Protestants would have attended a worship service in a church within the last 7 days. 71%. You know what it is now? 47%. So almost half. In other words, the number of people who would be attending Protestant worship services is half of what it was 50 years ago. And we wonder why things are the way they are. We wonder why the culture is going in the direction that it's going in. And let me tell you, it's more prevalent amongst younger people not to be churchgoers. Most of us grew up in a time when it was kind of assumed that everyone was churchy. Most of the people you knew, most of your friends, they either went to church, at least they were at least closely connected with some church. And you invited them to church, they didn't look at you like you were some seven-horned beast. Things have changed. And we're having all this controversy now about gun control, and you and I understand something. That it's not really about guns, it's about people. That there's something about people that has changed. Our culture has changed. Our social network has changed. And not for the good. And we also understand this, is that the gospel is the only thing that ever makes a difference. The only thing that ever changes, I mean really changes people. That same gospel that you and I heard and we believed it and we've practiced it and we're commanded to share it with other people. Do you understand that we want to look out on the world today and we want to blame the world for the way the world is? There really is a sense in which the church is most responsible. Because rather being outgoing, the church has become, in a lot of ways, ingrown. Concerned about itself, concerned about its members. Not concerned so much about the multitudes of people out there that don't know Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior. We were given the Great Commission to go and make disciples of all nations. We need to be about it. That's our Father's business. That's Jesus' business. Therefore, in the business of the apostles, therefore, it's our business. Not just mine. Every one of us. To share what we know with other people whenever given the opportunity. And sometimes to even make opportunities to do that. See, the world is as the world is. And the only thing that ever really makes a difference in the world is the church sprouting and growing. I don't imagine too many people in here are very concerned about the possibility that they may at one time have to give their life for their faith. But it's not inconceivable that that might happen. You might be one of those who's called upon to be a martyr, to give your very life for the gospel of Jesus Christ. And let me just say something. I don't think any of us ought to really be looking forward to the act of dying, especially if it's going to be very painful or very lingering or this, that, or the other. But we have to look beyond it. And this is what empowered the martyrs to do what they did, to give their life. And there are martyrs in the world today. There's going to be people martyred today in this world because of one reason, and that is because they know the Lord Jesus Christ and worship Him and serve Him. That world is so far and most of us, we can't even hardly connect to it. But that is the world that many, many of our brothers and sisters are living in right now. just like they did in Smyrna. We need to pray for them. We need to support them. We need to be willing to give up as they are. To be faithful unto death. And Jesus promises that to them he will give the crown of life. Life is a precious thing. The reality is this, and you and I have tasted life and we've enjoyed life, but we don't really have any measure of understanding what life in Christ eternally is going to be like. I really believe this. If we got a glimpse of it, you and I would be running to our deaths, getting there as quick as we possibly could by natural means or whatever. That's how good it is. One of the things that I always say when I do a funeral is this, is thinking about Marie Reese just a few weeks ago, and that is this. If Marie was given the opportunity to leave where she is now and come back and be part of the Springs family once again, would she do it? Would she come back again to be with her children and her grandchildren and everyone else? Are they that important to her that she would be willing to give up heaven now to come back? And see, none of us believe that for a minute. If you and I really saw what heaven is, we would be running. We would be running with all of our strength, with every ounce of energy that we have to that. Not away from it. Not trying to avoid it at all costs. We can't imagine it. It is so good. It is so great. It is so grand. We can't even think of it. But Jesus promises this not only to these believers in Smyrna, he promises it to every believer, the crown of life. So, that's Smyrna. We will move on next week. This morning we are going to administer the Lord's Supper.